These are the oldest stories. Online at oldeststories.net. We are setting our clocks back a few centuries to a topic that really probably belonged back in the Kassite era, but which will remain relevant well into the Iron Age and through the end of Mesopotamian civilization. We read the Enuma Elish way back in episode 29 of this podcast, which was right about 3 years ago now, and noted in that episode that it ends with a long listing of the names of Marduk, which I mentioned deserved its own episode to look at. Well, this is that episode. We look at the 50 names of Marduk, of which there might actually be as many as 53, depending on who's counting, and seek to understand each of them. But first, some context. The Enuma Elish was a long time ago, so I don't blame you for being a bit fuzzy on the details, but the details aren't actually super important, at least not for today's discussion. Way back in the beginning, stuff didn't have names, which largely means that stuff didn't exist. Then a bunch of gods were born across multiple generations, and there were various conflicts with Ea killing the first god, Apsu, then living in its corpse. Then the first goddess, Tiamat, got mad that all the younger gods were making too much noise, so there was an epic throwdown and Tiamat was defeated, allowing the creation of the current world order as understood by the Babylonians. However, all that plot isn't really the point of the story. The point of the story is that Marduk is better than Enlil. Indeed, Enlil, who at the dawn of the Middle Bronze Age was unquestionably the most significant of major gods in the land of Sumer and Akkad, barely shows up in the narrative. The entire story is really about Marduk and just how awesome he is, which is why nearly the whole of the last two tablets is nothing but praise for the god Marduk. And that praise is what we'll be looking at in a bit. But before we get to that, we need to look at how Marduk is set up in the story. The beginning of the Enuma Elish is a genealogy, the climax of which is Nudimmud, which is another name for Ea, which is another name for Enki, who is the clever god of creators, magic, and wisdom, and things like that. Ea is presented here as the greatest god to have been born so far, and during the first crisis in heaven, it's Ea who saves the day. He defeats the oldest of the gods and butchers his corpse. All this, though, is simply background information for the birth of Marduk, who ends up having three parents. His father is Ea, already established as the coolest of gods. His mother is Damkina, Ea's wife, and he's also somehow also kind of born of the Apsu. He's wombed, so to speak, through the most original of the gods. There are multiple dimensions to this genealogy. Now, most obviously, Marduk is awesome because he comes from the most awesome lineage, and is raised so well as to double his godliness just from the milk that he drinks alone. And he's just great in every conceivable way, but also, this is, by some counts, his first naming. He is Marduk, a name of unclear origin, which may have just been a name. He's the son of Nudimmud and Damkina. So-and-so, son of so-and-so, is of course the basic naming scheme for people in ancient Mesopotamia, and as we'll be seeing, to name something is to create something, or to imbue it with power, perhaps. So the naming and the creation of this god are metaphysically linked. Now there is also another older god who is already the son of Nudimmud and Damkina, and in taking up this genealogy, Marduk will be basically absorbing this other god as well, but we'll see that in a bit. But we shouldn't skip the political dimension to all of this. The exact date of composition of the Enuma Elish is heavily debated, but fortunately, the political reality being reflected here occurred over an extremely long period of time, like talking centuries here. You see, Enlil, god of wind, is classically considered the king of the Sumerian pantheon. Different cities at different times considered their own patron god supreme, but Enlil was generally recognized because of the central role that the city of Nippur played in religious geopolitics, being a very special religious city for much of the early period, and being the home of Enlil's primary temple. So while the city of Enlil was the greatest religious center, Enlil himself was king in heaven. However, in a transition which lasted several centuries, really, Marduk's city of Babylon considered itself to be the principal city of Sumer and Akkad, both politically and religiously. The politics side of thing was enforced through the success, first of the old Babylonian dynasty of Hammurabi, then the Kassite dynasty, and the religious side very slowly seems to have followed along, with the theoretical and theological idea of Babylonian supremacy being associated with the success of her armies and diplomacy in the region of Lower Mesopotamia. The Enuma Elish is a work of the Marduk cult, and represents the fullness of this transition from Nippur as central to Babylon as central. So even though it may have been written before the transition was actually completed in the real world, it represents what the Marduk priests spent centuries trying to convince everyone of. And it also represents what eventually became the accepted reality of the Lower Mesopotamian pantheon, at least by the post-Kassite period, which is where we are now in our timeline. This all explains why Enlil is largely absent from the story, except at the end where he shows up to subordinate himself to Marduk. But it also explains why Babylon is actually the city of Eridu. Now, the Babylonian Eridu connection is an odd one, and I actually did resist it a lot at first, partly because it comes up a lot in some really weird conspiracy nonsense, but at the heart of it, it goes like this. Babylon, by the Kassite period, is unquestionably the dominant city of Mesopotamia, at least south of the Assyrian area. Also, we know that the universe is largely static, so whatever the situation is now is probably the situation for all of eternity, at least ever since the gods set the world in order. Therefore, Babylon has always been the dominant city of Mesopotamia in precisely the same way as Oceania has always been at war with East Asia in 1984. However, it's pretty clearly established, despite what some have claimed, that the city of Babylon simply didn't exist prior to the 18th century BCE, many, many centuries after the dawn of Mesopotamian civilization. Some have claimed that there may have been a fishing village on that spot going back to antiquity, but given the wild claims of ancient lost empires that stem from this, I'm less and less inclined to grant even that without some kind of pre-Babylonian evidence for the existence of Babylon. You see, in the Babylonian era, you can find a fair number of documents which place Babylon anachronistically in the very early period of Sumerian history. However, this is explained by the fact that Marduk is the son and inheritor of Ea, also called Enki or Nudimmud. Ea's city is Eridu, which is genuinely among the most ancient cities of Sumer, with a real claim to having been the first great city of the entire region. However, by the time of Babylonian supremacy, whichever century you want to place it in, Eridu is basically a dead city. The coast of the Persian Gulf has receded by tens of miles at this point, at least. And the branch of the Euphrates River, which once passed through Eridu, has shifted course and no longer waters the town directly. At various points, the extremely ancient temples would be funded to a certain level, allowing a tiny population of priests and servants and a couple hangers-on to live there, but it's likely that they were always dependent on another town for sustenance in the later periods. Theologically, just as Marduk inherited from his father Ea, Babylon inherited from Eridu, and may even at one point have had a quarter dedicated to refugees from both Nippur and Eridu. Therefore, in later writings, Babylon was Eridu, and Eridu was Babylon. It needs to be stressed that this was only ever a theological and ideological linkage. Babylon was never literally Eridu, and Eridu was never literally Babylon. Babylon didn't exist prior to the 19th century. I did say 18th a minute ago, but certainly they didn't exist before the founding by the Amorites, and Eridu was largely dead by the Kassite period, though full abandonment wouldn't occur until the Neo-Babylonian period. The linkage was a literary conceit only, though I will acknowledge that perhaps in later eras, certain writers may have forgotten that Babylon wasn't actually super ancient, and had themselves become confused by this theological propaganda from the earlier ages. For instance, of course, the story of the Tower of Babel, which is a biblical reference to ancient Babylon, is almost certainly showing signs of later redactors being confused by the claimed antiquity of Babylon. And perhaps the original story was pointing to a ziggurat at Eridu, or potentially one in Uruk due to the connection with King Enmerkar and the god An. But it should be stressed that ancient Babylon was not the site of any spaceship landing sites, and ancient Babylon was not the home of a great antediluvian civilization, nor was it the Mecca of the Hyperboreans, nor was it the Wakanda-like home of hyper-advanced black people, or any such nonsense, because Babylon didn't exist certainly prior to 2000 BCE. Anyway, I've gotten a little bit off topic with that. It's been sitting in my heart for a long time now, so that's just how it happens. Marduk is great. That's the point of the story. He's greater than Enlil for sure, and don't you forget it. That is why Marduk becomes associated so strongly with the number 50. Because 50 used to be Enlil's number, and the only god with a greater number is An, who is theologically greater in a sort of metaphysical sense, but also less important and without any political constituency, because he's not the subject of active worship for the most part. Now that we've established how great Marduk is, the next section of the Enuma Elish is focused on making sure we know how powerful Tiamat and her general Kingu are, as well as the strength of their army. All the other gods are totally stumped by how to beat her, and disaster is sure to befall the entire universe since it seems no good guy is powerful enough to fix the situation. But fortunately, did we mention that Marduk is super awesome? When all hope is lost, Marduk can save the day. And Marduk is willing to save the day, but before he does, he requires that the gods convene a council to appoint him with, you know, absolute authority over all the heavens and everything. Just a little, you know, a little condition. This is another naming, though it's not explicit yet, it'll get repeated again in the names list as Lugal-Dimarankia. Then Marduk goes out, powered up by his new name, and he wins the war. having won the war, and this is important, before he gets any names, he sets the world in order, creating temples and cities and humans. Then, and only then, does he settle into his throne while the many gods gather before him to worship and celebrate with a listing of the 50 names. And now, before we get properly into the naming, though, there's some more naming to take care of first. Marduk's bow gets established as a constellation, and the three stars involved in this don't get described well enough for us to identify where they were, but the names and meanings of each are explained. Then Anshar speaks. Now, Anshar is the oldest still-living god at this point in the narrative, his two parents being the now-defeated Tiamat and Abzu. Anshar is the father of An, who in most Mesopotamian pantheons is the oldest and most senior deity, making Anshar even older and more senior. And his role here is to give Marduk a name before launching into the 50 names sequence. That name is Asaluhi, and the power of this name is tremendous. You see, there's already a god named Asaluhi, though he's going to pretty quickly now get fully syncretized into Marduk, and he's hugely important for regular people. Asaluhi is the son of Nutamud and Damkina, just like Marduk, but being the son of the god of magic, Asaluhi is basically the greatest sorcerer. Now, I suspect that Asaluhi was, in ancient times, the subject of some very popular myths and narrative stories, but we don't have any surviving. I just get the impression from how he's discussed that most people would have been about as familiar with him as people nowadays are with Doctor Strange or Merlin or someone like that. We talked last episode about how significant magic and demons were in the ancient world, and we largely skipped over Asaluhi, the most famous of protectors and most famous of magicians, because I knew he'd be part of today's discussion. There is a famous incantation, now known as Marduk Against the Demons, or some variation of that, written from the perspective of Asaluhi, in which the god repeatedly explains his astonishing amount of power over the world, and particularly his power over demons. We often see Asaluhi in incantations either as the purported original author of the magic spell, or as a being being invoked to protect or cause some magical effect. But now that Asaluhi is revealed to have been Marduk all along, surprise, surprise, all those incantations now mean something completely different, or at least somewhat different. For me, this is puzzling sort of on two levels. First of all, we can speculate as to whether this syncretism happened first at the popular level and is now being officially codified, or if it's coming from the temples and intended to affect the popular religion. But I don't think we have enough evidence to really say either way, but more curious to me is this. I know that fans of, like, Star Wars and Marvel comics, they get so upset at this sort of retconning, where you go back and change already established lore. But how does it work when it's literally your religion getting shifted? Imagine all the scandal around Disney ruining Star Wars, but like the Pope's involved somehow. Anyway, for all the history of Asaluhi, the establishment of Marduk as Asaluhi is remarkable and gives one more key insight into the nature of ancient magic. The name is bestowed and praises are sung to Marduk, of course, but then as part of explaining Marduk's power, they begin to list off his responsibilities in there with his power. He's to establish and rule over the system of offerings by which mortals sacrifice to the gods. He's to cause humans to construct temples and to obey divinities. He's to rule over the divination signs. Now imagine you're a farmer and you need a god to help you with something, to grant a blessing or remove a curse of some sort. You might start by asking the god directly, but if he ignores you, the next logical step would be to go to Asaluhi, who has the power to affect the god's food and worship supplies. I mean, imagine if the manager of your local grocery store told you that you would be banned from the grocery store unless you changed your behavior towards this farmer. That's likely to catch your attention pretty quickly. And after this, we finally get to the point, the 50 names themselves. We begin with the name Marduk, which was already his name, but this first couple names in the set is recapitulating the plot of the story we just heard, the Enuma Elish, albeit in a more triumphant manner. Following each name is a little speech, sometimes short, sometimes long, which both explains the name and praises the god, making this fundamentally a didactic work. And for example, the first one explains the name of Marduk with, who, from his birth, was named by his forefather An, establisher of pasture and watering place, who enriches their stables. Though we don't see anything of Marduk before he was patron of Babylon in the historical record, it appears his earliest origin was as some kind of agricultural deity. And the praise continues, who by his deluge weapons subdued the stealthy ones, who saved the gods his forefathers from danger, and that being a reference to the plot of the story we just heard, he is indeed the sun, the most radiant of gods. And that is both sun as in child and sun as in fiery skyball. There's only a pun there in English, it wouldn't have been confusing in Akkadian. They shall walk in his brilliant light forever. Which is also Marduk taking over duties from Shamash, who is actually the sun. On the people whom we made, creatures with the breath of life, he imposed the god's burden that those be released. We've covered the creation of humans, and the status of humans is basically clay robot slaves for the gods before, but note that even though it's always Ea or Enki who takes the lead in creating humans, Marduk here gets the credit, because the king always gets the credit for the work of those beneath him. Creation, destruction, absolution, punishment. Each shall be at his command. These shall gaze upon him. And that closes out the meaning of Marduk. Only 49 more names to go. Next is Maruka, meaning the god who created them, referencing humans, since it reiterates the point that humans exist to allow the gods to rest from working all the time. The next name is Marutuku, meaning that the land, city, and people will trust and obey him forever. Mer-Shakushu is a two-part word, mer meaning angry and shakushu meaning calm. If you remember the poem of the righteous sufferer, there the poet waxed lyrical about how Marduk is both full of rage and full of calm. And here we note that he is angry but deliberative, furious but relenting, capable of all feelings, and everyone else just has to ride out his moods. The next name is Lugal-Dimarankia, or Lord of All the Gods, a name he's already been given in the story, but here it's reconfirmed. It's followed by Nari Lugal-Dimarankia, which is basically the same thing, but with more of a focus on Marduk as instructor and orderer of all reality. After this, the next section of names all seem to come in themed groups. So first we get Asaluhi, formally bestowed upon Marduk, which we already discussed. Then we hear that Asaluhi was also named Namtila, which means the god who maintains life. In this case, he has metaphorically resurrected the gods who were under a death sentence, which Marduk lifted through his victory in battle. This isn't an actual resurrection story, at least as we have it. It isn't a dying and rising god, as some have claimed. It is possible that another story or another version of the story had Marduk actually resurrecting the dead, but currently we aren't aware of any such version, making this a purely metaphorical resurrection, and likely, maybe, something promised also to believers in Marduk who felt deeply persecuted or felt themselves to be in very poor condition for whatever reason. Those who have faith, it seems, in Marduk and give him lordship over all will be metaphorically resurrected, that is, lifted out of the hard conditions into something better. Now, the third name of Asaluhi, and we're in the Asaluhi set, so this name of Marduk is a name of Asaluhi, and in becoming Asaluhi, he's gaining these Asaluhi names. So the third name of Asaluhi was Namru, which means the one who purifies the ways. Now, all three of these Asaluhi names are particularly powerful ones, and are bestowed by the three most senior of the remaining gods, Anshar, Lahmu, and Lahamu. Now that closes out Tablet 6, and also closes out the first section of the name listings, the one most directly related to the events of the Enuma Elish. What follows in Tablet 7 is more of just a listing of names and praises for the god. It begins with the Asari set of names, which begins, of course, with Asari, meaning bestower of cultivation. But when we get here, we also find that there exists a commentary tradition on this tablet from the ancient world, which gives us an unparalleled window into ancient scholastic traditions. You see, we tend to think of commenting on other texts as a hallmark of medieval scholastic philosophy. And indeed, the scholastics did produce voluminous commentaries on commentaries in their day. But the idea of just making margin notes or whole separate commentary works discussing other important texts does in fact go all the way back to Mesopotamia and is a pretty obvious kind of invention when you think about it. These commentaries that we have are often etymological in nature, trying to explain the meaning of a word by examining its component parts, much the way we nowadays might explain the word television by pointing out that the first part, tele, is Greek for distance, and the second part comes from the Latin visio, to see. So, televisio. The whole process is far more complicated in cuneiform Akkadian, since they have both Semitic languages and Sumerian to draw upon, and can arbitrarily pull apart the cuneiform characters to find supposed roots. But the whole project of cuneiform commentary and etymology is a topic for a later date, because it's really something else. For now, it's enough to know that some later scholar examined the 50 names of Marduk and attempted to associate these supposed etymologies to the aspects of the god. We're not going to criticize these etymologies today. We're going to accept them as the best understanding of the scholar who wrote it, but we should keep in the back of our mind that both that the commentary was written centuries later, and that some of these etymological methods are nowadays poorly regarded by modern scholars looking at this ancient philosophy. Anyway, we're in the Asari names, and our commentary lets us know that the name Asari can be broken down into components. Ru is bestower, Sar is cultivation, A is border, Ra is establish, Ru is creation, Sar is grain and herbs, Sar red as Ma is cause to sprout, and Sar is vegetation. Now, in one sense, you can sort of get a feeling from those word meanings that gives you a sense of what the commentator thinks a sari means. Something agricultural, but also establishing borders, like in a field maybe. But as to how he got there, how he found so many components in such a short word, well, that's what polysemism is about, and that's a story too complicated for today. So I'm just going to include some of these commentaries as an interesting supplement to the main 50 names explanations for as long as the commentary is not too damaged to read. The next of the Asari names is Asar Alim, honored in the House of Council, whom the gods heed without fear. The commentary pulls out the meanings house, council, honored, excelling, counsel, god, heed, fear, and learn. That Alim is the honored part, but it's a good example of the complexity of the ancient cuneiform languages that the same Asar is in both Asari, with an agricultural meaning, and Asar Alim, with the meaning of houses and council. Now the third Asari name, then, is largely the same but more emphatic, Asar Alim Nuna, honored light of his father, who assigns portions for the gods, implements their decrees, and increases abundance in the land. The commentary here is too damaged to read. After this, we get into another set of names, the Tutu names, beginning as usual with Tutu. Tutu is all about restoration, both the purification of holy places and also in the restoration of life. And through that restorative ability, he is uniquely exalted among the gods. The commentator drew out etymologies involving effect, restore, he, purify, shrine, relieve, devise, spell, be at rest, be angry, and rise, among others. Tutu is also Zuikkenna, the life of his people. Zuikkenna established the order of the heavens, and this was for the benefit of the mortals who will love him forever. The literal translation here from Sumerian characters is life of the masses, and the commentator suggests determined station, must not forget, hold deeds, and from among the teeming masses, as etymologies or sub-meanings. Tutu is also Zikku, maintainer of purity and god of the good wind. Good wind here being both a climate thing and also a positive spirit. Compare to last time how we often saw demons being thought of as evil winds of various sorts. So as Zikku, he maintains purity in both an ecological sense and a spiritual one, and the two were deeply interconnected in the ancient mind. Zikku turns want into plenty. He saves one from dangers, and he establishes abundance. The commentary here, which is the last one that's really readable for a while, is all pretty similar to this, finding maintain purity, wind or spirit, God and Lord, produce abundance, and so forth. Tutu is also Agaku, Lord of the Sacral Spell, which could potentially be a generic thing. You know, spells are usually pretty sacred, but in this context is probably referring to a specific spell reviving the deathly ill, which has been metaphorically used here to revive the gods who were under threat of certain death. We are told that in this name, he shall never be forgotten. Given how cuneiform culture died out completely until archaeology resurrected it in the 19th century, I can't really say that this prediction panned out in the long run, but anyway, the last Tutu name is Tuku, also related to the same sacral spell, which shall ever be on the lips of the good to drive away the evil. Next, we find ourselves in the Shazu name, starting with Shazu, literally from the Sumerian meaning he who knows the heart. And the writer here clarifies that Shazu knows specifically the heart of the gods, and is therefore capable of administering justice, that knowledge being coupled with Marduk's mighty power. Shazu is also Zissi, who defeated all who opposed him, and thereby removed fear from those who support him. The literal meaning here is silencing fear, though modern scholars think there's a level of wordplay in this and other names which is now totally obscure to us. Shazu is also Shurim, who uproots his enemies with weapons, and generally finds himself in a position of military victory. This victory naturally causes great joy to all. Shazu is also Sugurim, an expansion on the previous name Shurim, also uprooting his enemies with violence, but on a grander scale. The fifth Shazu name, Zahrim, is similarly the same destroyer of adversaries, but on a yet greater scale. And the sixth Shazu name, Zahgurim, is still greater. He is he who destroys all foes in battle. We shouldn't be thought that this is repetition just to fill out the list, though. There exists an ancient poetic form, which seems common to many Semitic cultures, in which this sort of repetition and expansion is used to create hyperbolic emphasis. Marduk is maximally victorious, we're told, but then even as we're told this, his quality of victoriousness grows ever further, suggesting that, like an anime character, Marduk is continuously in the process of surpassing the maximum. This is rather like our modern concept of infinity as something that is maximally large and yet perpetually increasing, which is being groped at before the concept itself had been formally invented. The next set of names begins with Enbelulu, which literally means something like Lord who made them flourish, them being unclear as to whether it's talking about gods or men, but flourishing is defined as naming them, instituting offerings, and importantly, establishing grazing places and watering holes for the herdsmen and opening canals for the farmer. Enbelulu is also Epidun, whose exact meaning is hard to translate, but could be something like open land and flood, or filling with water. Either way, something to do with well-irrigated fields and the canals which keep them watered. Enbelulu is also Enbelulu Gugal, irrigator of the waterways of the gods, and therefore lord of abundance, producer of wealth, bestower of grain, and so forth. Finally, Enbelulu is also Hegal, meaning heaps up abundance, and which the Enuma Elish writer connects to these other irrigation meanings as well. Next we get to the Sirsir set of names, and these are interesting. Now some of the names so far that we've seen are names of known independent gods whom Marduk is essentially eating. Others of these names are titles and duties, which may or may not have been the names of minor gods, or they could just be roles that Marduk is assuming. We'll probably continue debating that until we find confirmation of these minor gods actually existing. Sirsir, however, is clearly the name of some god, but not one that we know of outside this narrative. Sirsir is a divine person of some sort who battled against the ocean, which is a fairly common mythic motif, who's clearly being absorbed into Marduk. We don't know that Sirsir had a domain of any sort. All we hear here is that he defeated Tiamat, created land on top of her or from her corpse, and he crossed the vast ocean multiple times and perhaps fought a single combat atop a bridge. Well, Sirsir may have done all that, but now Marduk did it, so Sirsir can just go home. Sirsir is also Malah, who appears to have been Sirsir's sidekick, who piloted the boat on which Sirsir rode at some point in Sirsir's narrative. The last 20 names on the list are what's called the independent section. While we do sometimes get groups of related names, they aren't explicitly related anymore in the way that the previous names were. These are much shorter, the writers clearly getting worn out by Marduk's limitless glory, and so starts us with Gil, granter of the land's seed, who provides barley, grain, and herds of animals. Gilima establishes the bonds of the gods and created things, all which endure forever. Agilima controls the snow and created the high places. Given the local geography, snow and mountains would have had a pretty strong conceptual link. They wouldn't have seen snow outside the mountains. And the point is mostly that Agilima is a very high-up entity, living way up in the sky and is therefore much better than us mud-based dirt crawlers. Zulum is his name for his role in assigning fields, and as assigner of fields, he's also the one who assigns food offerings, since different regions around a town would have been assigned to the upkeep of this or that temple or to the palace. We get our commentary back for Zulum and learn that the name was thought to include the idea of knowing and measuring off fields or tracks. Mumu is a name we've seen in earlier myths, a creator god. And indeed, that's the literal meaning of the name in the early Sumerian, here taken to be the creator of heaven and the lower worlds, typically including both earth and the realm of the dead there in that lower worlds. Zulumu appears on its face to be a combination of Zulum and Mumu, and would therefore suggest both creating and organizing the universe. But the only discussion we have of this name is, to who no other among the gods was equal in strength. The next name, Gishnumanab, has the word seed in it, and means creator of all people, but also destroyer of the gods of Tiamat, using that destruction for the act of creation. He's also Lugal-Abdubur, thwarter of Tiamat. The commentator notes here that Lugal, of course, means king, but the rest of it can be parsed in two ways. Abdubur can be the ocean foundation, either making Tiamat, who is the ocean goddess, beneath all things, or in the literal forming her as the foundation of the earth. Or it can be parsed Abdubu, something like Tiamat, or the ocean, is thwarted or rooted out by actions, maneuvers, or weapons. As far as we can tell, the commentary tradition doesn't take these two different readings as options to pick from, but as facets of Lugal-Abdubur's nature, all present simultaneously. Like I said, the methods of the commentary aren't really clear from these English summaries, but when you look into them deeper, it isn't really always certain that we understand what exactly the commentators were trying to say, even when we understand clearly what's going on with their etymological exercises. Anyway, next is Pagalguena, the greatest of the gods, his brothers. Then is Lugal-Durmach, greatest in the house of kingship. He is also Ara-Nunna, counselor of his father Ea, and thus wise enough to advise the god of wisdom, as well as being both fair and noble. He is Dumaduku, son of the Holy Hill, king of the Holy Hill being a title of Ea, his father who always relies on Marduk for decisions. It isn't totally clear if the Holy Hill is Ea's ziggurat, or if the title predates any major construction and refers to Ea originally being a topographical deity, lord of some random hill probably near Eridu. Lugal-Shuana is a title of strength for the god whose strength is above all others. Iruga is a name meaning ravager of all, though the gods clarify here that Marduk is a ravager of all among his enemies particularly. But by a different derivation, the name also means all wisdom or all perception. And so the text decides that Iruga is both ravager and wise man, which is a connection we don't usually make nowadays. Rukingu is a related name, specifically Ravager of Tiamat's divine general Kingu. Kinma is he who causes earthquakes and whirlwinds to pass through the gods when they fear him. Esizkur is literally the house of prayer. He is the dweller in such a house where other gods come to pay homage to Marduk, and Marduk essentially holds court over the world, passing judgments on lifespans and decrees of creation. Gibil is a difficult one, and even the commentator appears to have trouble with it. The name is praised as one who, because of the great battle, can create great things, and whose thoughts are too subtle for even other gods to comprehend. The commentator pulls out the ideas of permanence, establishment, battle, Tiamat, create artfully, profundity and wisdom, perception, heart, remote, and comprehend just in the portions which are not damaged, though we can see from the scratches that he clearly continues even past this in the damaged portion of the tablet. Addu, by contrast, is the god as Sky King. Covering the sky and producing thunder and rain, wrath and abundance side by side. Asharu is the assembler of the gods of destiny, thereby taking charge over fate. Nibiru, the 49th name, is taken as intensely complex, both in the poem and in the commentary, but centers around fairly high-level ideas of passage between heaven and earth, of perhaps a tunnel or a liminal deity who both rules over both realms and therefore rules over all important passageways between them. This may not seem super important, but for the priests and diviners who build their career around divine signs and magical invocations, this is probably at least equal in importance with Asaluhi, the great wizard. And finally, after the gods have pronounced these 49 names upon the greatest of all gods, Father Enlil makes his appearance, generally bestowing a variant of his own name upon Marduk, calling him Lord of the World, which the commentator wastes no time in making clear is actually Enlil's own name, just in a more glorious form. Then Marduk's father Ea grants the 51st name, giving Marduk the name of Ea, causing him to be the Lord of Wisdom and Magic as well. Then Marduk is granted the sacred number of 50, thus replacing Enlil, who used to hold the magic number of 50, and all the gods praise him and celebrate, and they all live happily ever after. And now you know all the names, and therefore all the aspects of Babylon's great patron god, which the text urges all men to teach to their juniors. There's a fair bit of subtlety in all of it, which would take a good deal more effort to fully draw out, and there's much that we probably just don't understand in all of this, even beyond the missing sections of text and commentary. But in general, we see Marduk as still a being with domains, but also we see how he's eating the more specific domains of the more common sorts of gods, and expanding his role in a way that brings a great deal under his already pretty broad umbrellas. He's a god of fertility, a destroyer of enemies, a healer and a savior, a king of gods, a provider to the gods, and a master of magic. Now this is far from the end of what could be said about the 50 names. And I could, in theory, having now gone through the list once, now go through it again, with the focus on thematic interconnections between the names, then go through it again, teasing out yet more subtleties of the individual names, then perhaps another pass just on the interplay of Sumerian and Akkadian grammar, and then just go hog wild with all the occult stuff. Only some of the occult stuff would actually have been recognizable to the ancient world. A lot of it's just made up nowadays. And each of those passes would take even longer than this one has. But though Marduk is a nearly inexhaustible mine, I find myself quite exhausted. So join me next time as we take a nap. Or, more precisely, take a first stab at ancient Mesopotamian dream interpretation. Thank you for listening.